This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Kids spend years and years by your side. They're in school learning the rules of the game, how our culture works, how to be polite, the differences between right and wrong. But robots, you know, we're seeing more and more of them everywhere you look, and almost all of them are born with sociopathic tendencies, according to my next guest. They know only what their instructions tell them to do, which is usually accomplish a task as quickly and efficiently as possible. But in the real world, that might mean, what, cutting in line, stealing, other not-so-friendly endeavors and behaviors? So how do you teach these robots how to behave ethically with good etiquette? In other words, how do you turn them into stand-up robotic citizens? That's what we're going to be talking about. Give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SciTalk. And, of course, you can tweet us at SciFry. Mark Riddle is an associate professor in the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. He presented his latest work last week at a meeting of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. And it was in Phoenix. I bet you didn't even know there was an organization about the advancement of artificial intelligence. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what is this all about? The last time we talked, you were training robots to learn story plots and write fiction, and now you're teaching them to behave like good citizens. And you're doing this by analyzing stories, copying the protagonist's behavior. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So what we've been seeing over the last few years is really this kind of keen interest in the question of what happens when robots and other artificial intelligence agents like Siri and Cortana really start engaging with us on a more of a day-to-day kind of social level. And the question arises, are these going to be safe? Are they going to be able to harm us? And I don't just mean in terms of, you know, physical damage or physical violence, but in terms of disrupting kind of the social harmonies, in terms of, as you mentioned, cutting in line with us or insulting us. And what happens is when robots are trying to super optimize, they can do this quite unintentionally. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to try to teach agents kind of the social conventions, the social norms that we've all grown up with and we all use to get along with each other. And the question became, how do we get this information into the computer, into the robots? They don't have an entire lifetime to grow up and to share these experiences with us. And we looked at stories, and stories are a great way, a great medium for communicating social values. People who write and tell stories really cannot help but to instill in most parts the values that we cherish, the values we possess, the values we wish to see in good, upstanding citizens, in the protagonists, in the people that we talk about when we tell stories.
Give me an idea of the stories that you're reading to them or telling them.
Well, there's kind of two different parts to this. There's kind of the long-term vision where we imagine feeding entire sets of stories that might have been created by an entire culture or an entire society into a computer and having them reverse engineer the values out. So this could be everything from the stories we see on TV and the movies and the books we read, really kind of the popular fiction that we see.
But you must have to pick and choose between what, you know, the kinds of moral stories and ethical dilemmas that you want, because if you sit there and watch television, you're going to think everything is about shooting to you know, and cops and robbers.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a really kind of a good point. So But cultures are and societies are not monolithic, right? So there's lots of different attitudes and interpretations that go into that. But when you look at an entire set of fiction that's created by an entire society, there's going to be such a huge amount that what machine learning systems do, what artificial intelligence is really good at doing, is picking out the most prevalent signals, the most prevalent parts. So the things that it sees over and over and over again, time and time again, are the things that are going to kind of rise and bubble up to the top. And these tend to be the values that the culture and the society cherish. So even though we see, say, a lot of TV shows now with anti-heroes, that's still a vast minority of the things that our entire society has output. Mm-hmm. So it's going to pick up on the most common values that it sees. And I would actually argue that we don't want to cherry pick, because by doing so, we might run into the danger of, you know, unintentionally reinforcing certain behaviors.
Yeah, that's what
Whereas the computer should pick everything out and find the things that it needs to find for itself.
And so what do you train the robots or the computers in them to do? What, give us an idea.
Right. So at this stage of things, I'm working on a software artificial intelligence system called Quixote, which is named after the book by Cervantes. And we're still in very early stages of the research. So what we do now is we're still giving the system very simple stories, very childlike stories, really kind of procedures. So here's a story about how you catch an airplane, or here's a story about how you might pick up your groceries or pick up a prescription drug from a pharmacy. And they're somewhat literal. You know, John walks to the bank. John withdraws the money. John stands in line waiting for the teller. Those sorts of things. Because those are stories that are a little bit easier to understand. But what it turns out is when you ask people to tell stories, even that simple, they tend to tell the computer what should happen, what the computer should expect to happen along the way. And again, these kind of encode the kind of quote-unquote right way of doing things, the ways that they would choose to do it, the things that kind of innately bypass the negative results, meaning that they don't steal, they stand in line, they're polite to people, so on and so forth.
So you're actually putting your moral and ethical values into the robot.
Well, whomever we choose to tell the stories to the robot. So we chose stories not only because they're very good at conveying the social values. Again, authors really innately can't help but to encode their own values into the actions of the protagonists. But also stories are easy, very easy to tell. So virtually anyone could program a robot or program an agent, an AI, simply by telling stories. We don't have to teach people how to teach computers.
But just as humans can make cultural faux pas in different countries, wouldn't we also need to tailor robots to the culture that they are living in?
Absolutely, and that's a really great point. So different societies do have different social conventions that they follow. They're sometimes very different, sometimes very superficial. So we would want to, if we want to deploy a robot or an agent in any sort of society, we would really need to go to that society and collect the stories that come from that society. So it's learning to kind of be immersed in that culture, in that society. Uh-huh. So we definitely want to see different versions of these agents and artificial intelligences for different parts of the world, for example.
In the movie Ex Machina, Ava, the robot, is trained by using big data, big Google searches. Of course, spoiler alert, the outcome is not so good. Did you consider this kind of method instead of just storytelling?
Well, what we're actually doing is in working towards a big data approach. But instead of taking all the data in the world, what we want to say is let's focus on stories because those are where the values of a culture are going to manifest themselves more correctly. So it's if you want to say people who tell stories are not objective, they're it's not, you know, all the financial records of a complete society, which might lead you towards a more kind of super rational sort of decision-making process. There's personality, there's behavior, there's really, if you want to think about stories in writ large, they're examples of how to behave in society. Stories have everything from meeting with another character to in a restaurant and the social protocol you go through there to exemplifying, you know, the moral standards of, let's say, trying to save the universe.
Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there's the story of Bernie Madoff that is a different kind of story that reflects real life.
Yes, but when you think of the protagonists as being those characters that exemplify the things that we see as the best parts of our society, antagonists or the bad guys are the opposite, and they kind of get their just desserts. So you should be able to, in theory, learn that certain behaviors lead to negative outcomes.
Are there any bedtime stories, as a better way of putting, because it sounds like you're starting like on childhood level with the robots, that you could point out to us that you tell the robots?
Yeah, well, I think children's stories are a great place to start because they do tend to convey some of the simpler social constructs we have and some of the simpler values and morals we have. Mm-hmm. My son is 2.5 years old right now, and he loves to watch a TV show called Peppa Pig. And every episode of Peppa Pig, the protagonist goes out to do something new, goes on a field trip the first time to a ski slope and what to expect, what you do when you get to a ski slope and the things that kind of follow from there. And there's usually some sort of kind of moral about, you know, making a right choice versus a wrong choice as well. And combined with the fact that this is, you know, simpler language, I think, you know, there's a lot that we can learn very immediately from these children's sorts of stories.
Do you teach the robots that story? You read?
We're still at a simpler stage yet. Natural language processing is very hard. Story understanding is hard in terms of kind of figuring out what are the morals and what are the values and how they're manifesting. Storytelling is actually a very complicated sort of thing. We're just now starting to look at corpora or sets of children's stories now.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you get a lot of suggestions from people about what stories to tell your robots.
Oh, yeah. Everyone has their favorite stories. But I do think at the end of the day, the artificial intelligence has to look at all the stories and make the judgments themselves to basically say lots of these stories are repeating the same themes, and those themes are more important than the ones that are not repeated.
Mm-hmm. So right now you're very early stage. You're not reading them the Harvard bookshelf of that kind of stuff or even children's stories, but trying to figure out what the best simple ones are.
Yeah, and right now we have a very explicit storytelling model where right now we're looking at agents that can do one thing at a time. So we have an example of an agent that we want to teach that to go to and pick up prescription drugs at a pharmacy. So what we do is we tell it a number of stories about different things that might happen on the way to do that.
Right.
So right now the artificial intelligence is not a general artificial intelligence. It's not going out and doing lots of different things. It has this one specific task, but we want to make sure it's going to do that task in the right way.
Right.
That it's going to follow the conventions of society.
Why call it Quixote, Don Quixote?
Yeah, so when we were trying to decide a name for the system, we looked at the classic novel by Cervantes, and the Don Quixote character in the book by the name was a fictional character who was reading stories about medieval knights, and then he decides to adopt the chivalrous values of the knights and actually start acting like those knights and going out and having adventures. So we thought, here's a character who is learning a set of values from a set of stories. What a great name for our computer.
Yeah, that is great. We wish you great success with it and come back and tell us about your results.
I look forward to doing that.
Mark Riddle, Associate Professor in the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech. He's a rambling wreck from Atlanta. Thanks for being with us today. We're going to take a break and talk to Carlo Rovelli. He's here with his 7 Brief Lessons on Physics. Great little book. Great read. I promise you there will not be a test. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Have you still been digesting the gravity wave discovery? You know, general relativity and quantum loop theory. Have you heard of that? Well, they're probably not topics you'd expect to find in the culture pages of the Sunday paper. But that's what readers of an Italian financial newspaper were treated to. A series of weekend columns by the theoretical physicist Carlo Rovelli on the greatest discoveries of modern physics. And they weren't real dense explanations for the connoscenti. Instead, they were written in hopes that anyone could grasp these foundational ideas and appreciate their beauty. And that is the philosophy behind his new book, 7 Brief Lessons on Physics, which clocks in at just over 80 pages. You can read this in a very short ride. And rarely has physics had so eloquent an interpreter. Carlo Rovelli is the author of 7 Brief Lessons on Physics and a theoretical physicist at Aix-Marseille University in France. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Was it a pretty brave editor who agreed to publish your physics essays in the paper?
He didn't agree. He asked me. I was pretty shocked by the idea at the beginning, but it worked very well. It went. In fact, we first talked about a single article, and then it became a series of articles, and it worked very well. People liked it enormously. And later, a book publisher asked me to transform these articles in a book.
Right. Let me give out our number so people can phone in and ask you questions, if I might interrupt. 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, 844-724-8255. You can ask Carlo the questions about things you'd like to know about physics, because he only has 7 brief lessons on physics in here. And Carlo, that's my next question. How did you narrow down everything you wanted to, you know, what there is about physics into just 7 lessons?
Well, the choice of the topics was pretty easy because This is a book about fundamental physics, just how we think is the fundamental structure of the world. So it's not about the physics of material or complex systems or anything like that. And I just made a short list of what we know about the world. There's not much that we know about the world. We know about space-time, we know about elementary particles, we know about the cosmos, we know something about heat and time. And we don't know much about quantum gravity, so I also described what we really don't know. And these are the main chapters of our knowledge of fundamental physics. Mm-hmm. The hard part was to squeeze each one down to a few pages.
I'll bet. But you did it very, very well and eloquently. In your first chapter on Einstein and general relativity, you write, "And it is at this point that an extraordinary idea occurred to him, a stroke of pure genius. The gravitational field is not diffused through space. The gravitational field is that space itself. This is the idea of general theory of relativity." This was a whoa moment for me, I got to tell you. The gravitational field is equivalent, you know, wow. Can you explain that a little bit more? Let me repeat it. The gravitational field is not diffused through space. The field is that space itself. What an idea.
Yeah, what an idea. It's a fantastic idea. It's one of the greatest ideas in science. Well, Newton had imagined that there is this space where things move in. Now we give it for granted, but it's really an idea by Newton. It was a great idea. So particles move in space. So I had this idea of this space. Space is like a big table over which things move. What exactly is this space is not clear. And then Einstein had to figure out how gravity works, and he thought it's more or less like electricity. And electricity is carried by the electric field and the magnetic field. So he had to find the analogous of the electric field, the magnetic field for gravity. He had to find what is a gravitational field. Except that instead of adding a field is something which is diffused all over in space. Einstein had this idea that the field was already there. This space is the table on which we live is not a fixed thing, but is something that moves. So this is the idea of that's the key idea of Einstein. The beauty is that out of this simple idea, all sort of incredible prediction came out, like the gravitational waves that we have discovered a couple of weeks ago, or the black holes, or the expansion of the universe. A lot of marvels that nobody believed at the beginning, and they all turned out to be true. That's a marvel of physics.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the great ideas of physics is now is trying to unite Einstein's, I guess, geometrical view of gravity, it's geometry here, with the quantum mechanics particle view of gravity. Is it possible, should we be able to detect these graviton particles that are predicted to be carrying the force of gravity?
For the moment, we are not capable of doing so. And not only that, but for the moment, we don't even have a consensus of a good idea, of a good theory for that. That's a big problem of quantum gravity. It's one of the chapters of the little booklet. And it's not something we have understood. It's something that we know we have to understand. So there are different attempts. I work on one of these, loop quantum gravity, which you mentioned at the beginning. The idea, but this is a theoretical idea. It's not something we know. It's something we think is going to be true. The idea is that this space, which is moving, which is also a field, is itself made by grains. So there's the grains of space, quanta of space. I think the magic of science, even more than what we have understood, is that we're always on the boundary between what we know and what we don't know. So we're always like explorer trying to look into the dark and try to see a little bit ahead, and we're not sure.
Tell me a little bit more about your idea of the loop.
The loop is because the effort as a scientist. I'm a scientist before being a writer. that's what I'm really am. The effort to understand quantum gravity is to understand this granular structure of space at very, very, very small scale, much smaller than the elementary particles. And in the theory we have, the structure is like if it was made by little loops or by little sort of a three-dimensional chain nail, little loops attached to one another, which together weave space like a t-shirt is weaved by threads, right? If you, a t-shirt seems something continuous, but if you look carefully, it has a structure. And space itself, we believe, has a structure. This is a quantum structure of space. So it's not really particles, it's not really grains of space, because these grains are attached to one another, weaved one with the other, in the form of little loops. That's the idea of loop. That's the attempt to bring together generativity and quantum mechanics.
So this is not strings theory, string theory. This is loop theory. It's
exactly.
Different.
Is exactly. We are in a domain where there are ideas around. There is a lot of work. There is, you know, people all over the world in the university that study, but there's no consensus yet. So there's one more than one idea, and probably strings and loops are the most studied idea at that point. So, you know, you find people who think that one is right and the other is wrong, and vice versa. So there's a big debate, and that's science at its best when there are different ideas. And so far, big questions, scientists have ended up converging and getting to a consensus. I hope is going to happen soon.
You know what? You talk to scientists, I talk to a lot of them, and they would rather not know the answer. I mean, they would rather the chase, the hunt is more fun than actually finding out the answer.
You're stretching it. I mean, I love knowing the answer, but I think it's right. It's true. Like it's people like people who go hunt, right? You don't really care about having hunted something. It's a search which is fascinating, and that's what I try to do in the book. Not just say, look, we know this, we know this, we know that, but tell the story of the passion of trying to see what we don't yet know. Make a list of what we know, but then the bigger. The large list of things we do not know.
Let me go through some of the questions that were raised while we were reading the book, and that is, why does time pass faster in the mountains, way above sea level, than at sea level?
Oh, that's a great question. It's a great question because it's one of these typical questions whose answer is very simple, is why not?
Next question.
the real story is that we have the habit. We sort of believe that time passes the same for everybody. But why do we believe so? Well, because we have seen this all our life. But we have seen this all through our life because we don't have very precise sense of time, right? It's like why the Earth is round. Well, why should it be flat?
It doesn't satisfy. I know that may be an answer. Why not? I could say that to anything, you know.
No. The point is that what Einstein really understood is not that space is curved. The precise story is that space time is curved. So what one has to think is that when you go high, time is sort of stretched. Like if you take a piece of rubber. And in the higher part of the rubber, you stretch it. And that's similar for space-time. So the higher part is stretched with respect to the lower part. And the reason is because the present of the Earth, which is a big mass, curves space-time, so slows down clocks near itself, so to say.
That I get. It's a greater curvature at the top there. So you're stretching space-time. That's a good answer. Let's a couple of more questions. Let's go to Jeff in Denton, Maryland. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me. I had a quick question. For the recent discovery of the gravitational waves when the black holes were merging, my question is, how did they quantify that? As in, was it a direct measurement or was it more so like a proxy of the actual phenomenon itself? Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Let me quantify. Is there a unit that we call a gravitational wave? Does it have a name, a unit, a dimension?
Yes. It's a precise quantity which is measured, which is not hard to get. The antenna is something long, 4 kilometers. And when a gravitational wave goes through, there is a change in this length of 4 kilometers. So out of 4 kilometers, there's a change of a teeny, teeny fraction of a centimeter, and that's what is measured. And the actual measurement is order of 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. So the strength of the wave is 10 to the minus 14 centimeters over 4 kilometers. It's very small, right? It's smaller than an atom.
Now they played a little audio clip when they made the discovery. Is that really? Could you hear it? Is it in the audio range, or did they have to fool around with that?
They have to fool around a little bit with that. It's not too far from the audio. Mm-hmm. The one that they played on the radio, which is quite emotional to hear it, it's a little bit stretched. There's a little bit the real one is a little bit shorter, but not much. Mm-hmm. So on the other hand, it's very low volume, right? So they had to amplify it.
Right. Talking with Carlo Rovelli, author of the great little book, Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. You write so poetically about this stuff. It really makes it easy to read. You have a passage at the end of your particles chapter that I especially like. I wonder if you could read it for us.
Sure. It would be a pleasure. All right. Couple of paragraphs?
Yeah.
So, for the moment, we have to stay with the standard model. It may not be very elegant, but it works remarkably well at describing the world around us. And who knows, perhaps on closer inspection, it is not the model that lacks elegance. Perhaps it is we who have not yet learned to look at it from the right point of view, one which would reveal its hidden simplicity. For now, this is what we know of matter, a handful of types of elementary particles which vibrate and fluctuate constantly between existence and non-existence and swarm in space, even when it seems that there's nothing there, combined together to in infinity, like the letters of a cosmic alphabet to tell the immense history of galaxies, of the innumerable stars, of sunlight, of mountains, woods and fields of grain, of the smiling faces of the young at parties, and of the night sky studded with stars.
That's beautiful. Beautiful.
Thank you.
How complete is the standard model? It's not perfect yet, is it?
No, it's not perfect. It's not perfect because it looks patchy. It's different pieces attached together. There's a lot of constant numbers inside that is not very clear where they come from. It has the look of something not nice and clean.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's right. It's all my life I've witnessed this. You know, people say, oh, we're going to discover it's wrong, and it keeps being right. It has happened even recently. People expected supersymmetric particles outside the standard model, and they were not found. So the standard model seems to be right.
What's it going to take to get your loop chainmail an accepted part?
That's a big question with a capital B for me. We are working on an attempt of a measurement of an effect which is predicted by the theory, which is about exploding black holes. So we expect that black holes might explode because of quantum gravity. We're trying to figure out if they explode fast enough so we could measure it. And I have a little hope before dying to see the measurement done. And that would be great happiness.
Well, sort of what Einstein was doing to the last 30 years of his life. I'm sure you're a lot younger.
Thank you for the comparison.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great luck. We're gonna talk more about it. We have to take a break. This is a great little read. Let me just repeat the book. It's Seven Brief Lessons on Physics with Carlo Rovelli. It is not hard to read. It is the kind of book you can sit down and read a chapter every now and then, or you could read the whole thing on a long train ride or an evening, in bed. Carlo, will you stay with us? We're going to take a little break and come back and talk lots more about physics and talk about a question we asked our listeners 1,500 respondents. We asked our listeners on Twitter which of these physics principles they'd most be comfortable explaining: general relativity, quantum mechanics, or elementary particles. We had 1,500 respondents, and we'll tell you what they said after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with theoretical physicist Carlo Rovelli, author of the new book, Seven Brief Lessons in Physics, a great little read. And you know, Carlo, these gravity waves have really ignited interest in people. They really, you know, I think two major science events recently, then that is going to Pluto and looking at all the photos from Pluto and the gravity waves, these two. And a lot of listeners are asking really interesting questions. Let me go to Tyler in Washington. Hi, Tyler. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I know we can change the electromagnetic spectrum by inputting energy, like in radio and stuff. But could we manipulate the gravitational spectrum at all with, like, energy or something like that?
Great question. Carlo, can we, you know, transmit gravity waves?
Yeah, it's a great question. The answer is, in principle, yes. In practice, no. So if we could, if we had enormous amount of power, but enormous means much, much, much bigger what we imagine of having, yes, we could just have a gravitational radio even. But in practice, the gravitational interaction is so small that even if we move very, very, very fast a mass, the amount of gravity wave produced is too small that we cannot detect them, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Why? Do we know why gravity is such a weak force? In other words, it needs such a big body to see it?
That's one of the mysteries. The other forces of nature, the other fundamental forces, electromagnetism and the nuclear forces, in comparison, are much, much stronger, but by many order of magnitudes. And one of the things that nobody understands why is why there is this huge discrepancy in strength of the forces.
Yeah, now my kitchen magnet is stronger than gravity, right?
Well, put it this way. Gravity pulls you down, but it takes the entire Earth to put you down. Well, your kitchen magnet, it's attracted by the refrigerator and takes just a little piece of iron to do the same.
Yeah, it's so weak, the gravity. Let's go to the phones again to Samir in San Antonio. Hi, Samir.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi there. Go ahead.
I have a question. There was a paper written in 2014 out of North Carolina, and I read it on physics.org, and it was talking about basically saying that black holes don't exist. It said that once the star collapses, it sheds so much mass that it can't form the black hole, hence no singularity and no event horizon. And it kind of blew my mind when I read that, so I was just wondering what his thoughts were on that paper, if he was familiar. I believe it was out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, but in 2014.
All right. Let me get to Carlo. What do you say to that?
There is a little bit of ambiguity in this. Sometimes people say that black holes don't form. If this means really nothing like that forms, I don't think this is an idea that gets a lot of support in the scientific community. On the other hand, people might mean something less strong. I do think that black holes are not exactly what people think they are, and Hawking thinks the same, because according to a textbook, black hole is forever, while there are good reasons to believe that black hole is not forever. So in a technical sense, that's not a black hole, but it looks like a black hole, it's weight like a black hole, it behaves like a black hole, it's just its future is different. So then it's a matter of words, whether you call it black hole or not.
Let's go to another call from Tim in Washington, D.C. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Dr. Rovelli. I feel like I'm talking to Lionel Messi. This is fantastic. My question
My question is,
have we collected enough data about that gravitational wave that LIGO detected that is possible to calculate harmonics from that? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, yes, that's a great question. Yes, we don't have just a single wave. We have a complicated shape of the wave. So we have a full spectrum of harmonics. We don't have just a single signal. We have a rich signal. That's why we, or perhaps I should say them, have been able to understand that it comes from two black holes with that particular mass, with that particular kind of motion, and they even figure out the distance. So the signal received, it's a rich signal with a lot of information in it.
Talking about black holes, the way you write about time as a factor of heat dissipating is really a beautiful, clear way of putting it. Let me read that. The heat of black holes is like the Rosetta Stone of physics, written in a combination of three languages, quantum, gravitational, and thermodynamic, still awaiting decipherment in order to reveal the true nature of time. It's beautifully written. I mean, I think people, of all the concepts that we have, the thing we get asked most about is time. How can you say that physicists say there is no such thing as time?
There is a sense in which there's no such thing as time. Of course, it has to be interpreted correctly. There is time for us, right?
Right.
We have a certain amount of minutes to talk and no more, unfortunately, and so on. But this does not imply that time is a fundamental concept for describing nature. Think about high and low. We know that there's up and down, right? Up is up there, down is down there. But in the universe, there's no up and down. So up and down are not elementary, not fundamental notions. Notions that make sense only here around the planet when there's a preferred direction and so on. So similarly, that's not something obvious, but many physicists, not something on which there is a total consensus, but many physicists, me included, think that if you want to describe the world at the fundamental level, time is not a good notion. You should not describe how things change in time. Just describe the relation between different things. It's not complicated. It's like instead of saying at 8 o'clock I wake up, at 9 o'clock I go to school, etc. I say when the sun is there I wake up, when this happened these other things happen. So I can talk about the world in terms of a relation between events without ever mentioning the word time.
Yeah, if you didn't have a clock, you wouldn't know that there is time.
That's right.
You would just say the sun rises, the sun sets, some stuff happens, but there's, you know, if you don't measure it, it's not time.
Exactly, exactly. And Newton told us that a good way to describe the world is to think that there is a unique time that passes, but maybe that's not a good way general. It's a good way only at our scales and not down in the in the smallest of things or in the largest of the universe.
What excites you most about the universe?
That is so different from our common sense, that time passes faster and the mountain the lower, that at fundamental scale there is no time, that space is different than we thought, matter is different than we thought. Heat is different than we thought. I feel we are like children who have an idea about the world, and then you know go away from their little town and discover the rest of the country, the rest of the planet, and see more and more and more about nature. And every time is wow, look, it's not what we thought; it's something else. It's this continuous rearranging our view of the world, which fascinates me.
You know, people say, what good is studying, knowing more about time? It has an intrinsic beauty, does it not? Understanding how the universe works? If you found a new Picasso painting, no one would ask you, why is that beautiful? We've now
exactly.
Found a beautiful way of looking at, you know, gravity. Why does that have to be explained?
I completely agree. I think that beauty is something which is there. We find in science, we find in physics, beauty sometimes is not easy, right? To appreciate music or to appreciate a Picasso or a great novel, it takes an effort. One has to learn. It's not immediate, but when you learn it when you get it, you say why, and you have new eyes for looking at the world and new marvel at the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is great beauty in your new book, Carlo. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. 7 brief lessons on physics. You really will enjoy this book. Carlo Rovelli, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Dr. Rovelli is a theoretical physicist at the Aix Marseille University in France. Virtual reality has existed in the main realm of science fiction and high-tech gamers for the past 30 years. You remember those bulky helmets that were rigged up to a power glove? The technology has been trickling into the mainstream. You have your Oculus Rift. It's made the gear more accessible. And there's the New York Times teamed up with Google Cardboard to tap into the empathic side of storytelling. And Facebook announced it's set up a team to bring the immersive medium to the social networking site. Will using VR as a social tool make it a reality? And do these virtual experiences change our real-life relationships, the IRL? Jeremy Bailenson is professor of communications, also the founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Zuckerberg didn't talk about any specifics about how FaceTime might use virtual reality, but he did visit your lab where you were studying avatars. Are we talking about SimCity here?
So Mark Zuckerberg, like many decision makers in tech companies, because I'm lucky enough to work in Silicon Valley, they come to my immersive virtual reality lab, which is a lab where we study not only the technology, but more importantly, the human response to the technology. So when Mark came to the lab, we gave him lots of simulations where he put on the helmet and he walked around scenes and he visited other places. But most importantly, he got to see what we call avatars, which is representations of other people inside the virtual world with you. And he got to experience the future of social interaction online.
Why would people want to communicate through virtual reality?
You know, I ask myself that question. I'm not one that uses social networking. I'm not one that texts. However, we do know that people love this technology. They love to interact with digital versions of others. What VR does is it takes all the gadgets away. It takes all of the multitasking away. And you actually feel like you're with someone. We call this social presence. You see their emotions, you see their gestures, and it feels just like you're in the room with them. Mm. It takes what is typically seen as something that's unemotional and distant and makes it feel like somebody's right there with you.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Jeremy Bailenson. How soon is it until we have, you know, a practical VR pair of glasses or something? You know, you got the big headsets. We all know that over the years they're going to shrink down in size, maybe be something just like a pair of regular glasses. How soon will this become mainstream?
So 18 months ago in my lab, we were using a head-mounted display that cost $40,000. We're now using one that costs $300,000, and the reason is it's just better, and they're getting cheaper and more comfortable. And I think we're at the point where the helmets are good, but more importantly, we're at the point where there's energy. And, you know, Ira, someone like you cares about this. And it's wonderful that I get to talk to your listeners about something I've been doing for decades, because now the hardware is actually around to allow us to have these neat social interactions inside VR.
And you are a cognitive psychologist. Your lab studies how virtual reality can influence real-life behavior. What have you found in your studies about this?
You know, when we started out, the questions we were asking in the late 90s and for the next decade, they were mostly around, can you replicate face-to-face quality interaction in VR? Meaning, can I do eye contact? Can I do what I call the virtual handshake, when you feel like somebody's there? What we then shifted toward was, we found out that, geez, you can actually make VR better than face-to-face. You can make it hyper-personal or more social than you can have in the real world. And there's a lot of ways to think about that. So right now, all of us, we're hearing my voice. But if we were, say, on Skype or some other technology, you would see how I'm looking right now. And, you know, the truth is I didn't shave today, and I'm not wearing a tie for this because you only hear my voice. And that vanity actually precludes us often from using things like Skype or from face-to-face visits, because you've got to present your optimal self. With avatars, you're always the way you want to look. You never have gestures that are inappropriate, because you can have algorithmic filters that solve that. You can actually be doing very strange things, for example, looking someone in the eye, but looking two people in the eye at once, and each of them feel like they're getting your own, they're only ones getting your eye contact. There's a whole class of things I call nonverbal superpowers, which is, I know it's a strange concept, but your avatar can actually be a better communicator than you can.
So when we talk about virtual reality, you're not talking about seeing the real me, you're talking about looking into an avatar world of things.
So I had every few years I have what's called an aha moment, which is, you know, I see a technology that I thought was 20 years away and is here now. And I was at, there's a company called High Fidelity, which if our listeners are familiar with Second Life, the CEO of that, his name is Philip Rosedale, has formed something called High Fidelity. I was there and they had their company meeting in VR and they let me join. And I was walking around and my body was moving as I was. I was doing hand gestures. I was literally walking around a space and I got to walk up to someone and literally shake their hand and feel haptic feedback. And wow, it was just a light bulb went off. I've been building these for years, and we've always theorized about how it can be ready for face-to-face. And I just had a really neat moment.
Well, when is it going to be ready for, you know, prime time, you think?
I think that there are a number of companies who are kind of doing an arms race right now to try to get these avatars that look like you and gesture like you out there. There's a company called FaceShift, which, again, talk about aha moments. I got to see photorealistic avatars that do just what you're doing. We're running a study right now in the lab where, you know, the end goal, Iris, is to replace travel that you don't want to do. So we should all travel when we want to, but let's get rid of commutes that are unnecessary, and let's get rid of business meetings where you fly across the world and burn fossil fuel for an hour-long meeting. Wow. And I really believe that the software and the hardware are here. We've just now got to use it.
Someone who has a face for radio would love to have a different avatar. Thank you. I can't wait to look like someone else.
I think we all share that sentiment.
Thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy Bailenson is professor of communications and the founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University. Thanks for joining us today. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks, as always, to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. You want some science with your snaps? Follow Science Friday on Snapchat. Yes, we're on Snapchat. No space. You get your geek fix all week long. That's Science Friday with no space. Science Friday, no space. We'll see you there on AppChat. There's some stuff up there right now. Have a great weekend. Snapchat. Did I say AppChat? Snapchat. Snapchat, no space. Science Friday. We'll see you there, up there right now. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato, I think, in New York.